I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas State Senator and Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate, Barbara Boyer, was once considered a long shot. The former Republican now has a leading edge in some polls and is trailing closely in others. Boyer, who is a retired physician, has focused her campaign on the need for affordable health care and expanding Medicaid. Today, we'll ask her why. Then, with Election Day getting closer, the ethics professors discuss the morality of choosing not to vote and whether political candidates are obligated to debate. We'll also talk about President Trump's conduct while he was infected with COVID-19. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Barbara Boyer is waging a determined fight to become the first Kansas Democrat elected to the U.S. Senate since 1932. Polls show a close race. We'll visit with Barbara Boyer in just a few minutes. Later, the ethics professors examine the ethics around not voting in this upcoming presidential election. First up today, it's KCUR's Sam Zeff with a look at the news. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Let's start again this morning with the pandemic. What's new there?
Yep, the average number of COVID-19 hospitalizations in the metro took a little dip yesterday, but still remains over 100 a day. This is from the Mid-America Regional Council dashboard, which says the last time hospitalizations were below 100 a day in the nine-county region was at the end of last month. A private nursing home, this is disturbing, a private nursing home in Kansas says 10 residents have died from COVID-19. This is from the Norton County Health Department. That's in far northwest Kansas. Says in addition to those 10 deaths at something called the Anby Home, 52 other residents have tested positive for the virus. So has some of the staff, according to the Norton County Health Department. And another Kansas county has made it into the New York Times top 10 for the highest percentage of COVID-19 cases per resident. The Times says Sheridan County, that's just west of Hayes, has the third highest rate of cases in the country.
We discovered an unusual fact about the federal death penalty yesterday, Sam.
Yep, the scheduled execution in December of Lisa Montgomery. That's going to be the third time a Kansan has been put to death this year since the federal government resumed executions. KCUR's Dan Margulies has that story. Well, maybe he doesn't.
Yeah, maybe it's not there.
Yeah. Maybe, I don't know what happened to Dan, but maybe he's not there. So there's been, was the woman who was convicted of kidnapping a woman and killing her in Skidmore, cutting the fetus out her and then taking the baby back to Malvern. She was arrested. She's on death row. That execution is set for December.
And finally, we're just 2 weeks away from Election Day. What's new in the world of politics today?
Yep. After 2 days of in-person voting in Johnson County, the election office says more than 20,000 ballots have been cast. In-person early voting started on Saturday, resumed yesterday. Election Commissioner Connie Schmidt said in a tweet that the busiest locations, Heritage Museum, that's the old King Louis Bowling Alley, Hilltop Blue Valley Conference Center, and the election office in Olathe. If you want to avoid long lines, she says, there are 7 others. You can go on the website and see those. Schmidt also tweeted that 20,000 mail-in ballots have been returned through drop boxes. And a little news from outside the area, but significant nonetheless, especially since we have Barbara Boyer on the program a little bit later. Larry Sabato this morning moved that Senate race in Iowa between incumbent Republican Joni Ernst and her Democratic challenger Teresa Greenfield from a toss-up to leans Democratic.
Wow. Interesting. Interesting development. That's KCUR Sam Zeff. Sam, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. The big political news out of Kansas this year is that a Democrat just might win a U.S. Senate race. This hasn't happened since the 1930s, and it's supposedly the longest losing streak for a party anywhere in the country. Barbara Boyer is a Democratic candidate. Her opponent is Roger Marshall, and polls show the race is too close to call. Barbara Beaulieu is a state senator representing Northeast Johnson County. She's a former member of the House. Her occupation is medical doctor. She's a retired anesthesiologist, and she joins us now. Senator Beaulieu, nice to have you back again. Welcome.
Steve, good morning. It's great to be here, and it's going to be a great day in Kansas.
You know, we're taping this on Tuesday, and I just saw that your campaign announced that it raised $13.5 million during the year's third quarter. That's an all-time record for a quarter for any candidate for any race in Kansas. Why is so much money pouring into Kansas this year?
You know, Steve, I am so humbled by the incredible support that I've received from all these hardworking Kansans, literally from all over the state. And we've really worked hard to build a grassroots campaign and have support from Democrats and Republicans and people from Liberal to Leavenworth. And as you maybe have heard me say before, I've had contributions from all 105 counties. And it's because Kansans know I am the only candidate in this race who will actually work across the aisle to get things done on issues that are important to them, their families. Things like affordable health care and, of course, funding for our schools, and definitely getting aid and help to people in Kansas who are struggling under this horrible, difficult pandemic. So my estimation is, you know, my message of independence, of bringing people together, being able to solve problems really is resonating with people. And I know what I hear is Kansans are tired of Washington politicians, people like Congressman Marshall, who just fight all the time and don't get things done for the regular people. And I want to change that. So people are supporting it.
You know, is Kansas changing? I mean, 20 years ago, nobody considered it to be anything other than safe Republican turf. What do you think is going on?
People want to be listened to. And the political spectrum has changed in, you know, I started as a moderate Republican. That's how I grew up. And here I have, you know, my role model, Senator Nancy Landon Kassebaum, supporting me as a Democrat. And over 100 Republicans currently or formerly elected have endorsed this campaign. So something's changing, definitely. And bottom line is people are tired of the fighting, the hyper-partisanship. They're looking for an individual who will actually listen and do the will of the people without partisanship, bottom line.
You know, the other story in this race right now centers on some comments you made earlier this month about guns. The campaign of Roger Marshall is circulating a video of you praising Australian gun restrictions. This is a law that in the 1990s forced owners of 700,000 guns to sell them to the government. In the video, you describe this as this amazing thing, and you talk about how safe Australia is. Do you support gun confiscation as a way to make Kansas safer?
You know, yet again, Roger Marshall takes my comments out of context. He cut the video. I was discussing my daughter who lives in Australia in the context of why we have a Second Amendment, which I support. Let me be clear and say it again. I don't support gun confiscation, never have, never will. I support the Second Amendment. And I'm a gun owner and learned to hunt and shoot with my dad. And it was such a great experience. And I am just so disturbed that my opponent, he just has these desperate attempts to mislead Kansas on my record. And, you know, taking something out of context, again, I support the Second Amendment.
You have said you're supportive of background checks for gun purchases. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, as do most people in this country, including the majority of NRA members.
In Washington a few days ago, confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett were underway. Would you vote to confirm her?
You know, no one, including me, should say how they're going to vote until they've actually heard her answers to her questions done by the Judiciary Committee. You know, this is a very, very serious issue, making sure that we have people on the court that will do follow the law. And I will be a person, if when I am there, I will be listening carefully to those nominees and evaluate them on their merits, their ability to follow the law, and of course, their temperament.
There's this big fight over the timing of this nomination, whether it should move forward at all, given how close the country is to a presidential election. Where do you come down on that, Senator?
You know, the senators who previously in 2016 voted and set a precedent saying we needed to wait because there was, you know, it was 9 months before an election. They need to follow that, and they should be doing exactly that. We're not only close to an election, we're in an election. And these are lifetime appointments for, you know, obviously we shouldn't rush them. And we truly should not be politicizing the judiciary and any of our Supreme Court justices. That's just flat out wrong.
And do you feel the process has been politicized because it's moving forward in the midst of a presidential campaign?
Well, what I will say is these senators said they set a precedent, and they said some of them were very clear. Hold me to my word. And that hasn't been done. So that's what it appears.
Barbara Beaulieu is my guest. She's a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate in Kansas. As you mentioned, you used to be a Republican and you switched parties toward the end of 2018. What drove you to do that?
You know, I grew up a moderate Republican here and believed that following the example of people, like I said, Nancy Landon and Kassebaum, was where my heart was, working across the aisle, working to make sure that we didn't just put party first, but put people first like she did. And ultimately, I just found myself at odds with Republican leadership on things like funding public education, the very backbone of this state and so important to us. And they were not funding it and doing things like expanding Medicaid. They actually have been blocking that when 80% of Kansans support expanding Medicaid. And of course, that horrible Brownback tax experiment that just decimated our state. I, you know, voted no against my party leadership, saying, I hope I'm wrong, because I love our state. I want it to be successful. I wasn't wrong. And it took joining moderates and Democrats together, we voted to end that horrible experiment. So ultimately, I found myself in 2018 endorsing Laura Kelly across party lines because she was the right candidate. It didn't matter what party, it was about doing what's best for the state. And, you know, Republican leadership got pretty darn mad at me. And ultimately, I realized that I could best serve the people. Becoming a Democrat, and I'm a very proud and pragmatic Democrat, but I want to be clear. My values have not changed. My votes have not changed. Republican Party leadership changed.
How tough a call was it for you to make that party switch?
It needed to be done. I'm a very strong individual, and I do what's right.
You grew up in a home where medicine and moderate politics were often discussed. Your mother was a precinct committee woman who attended college with Nancy Kassebaum at KU. Your father also was an anesthesiologist. Sounds like you're the perfect mix of the two, Barbara.
Well, that's my parents would have loved to hear that comment, Steve. They were tremendous role models. And, you know, one of the number one things they taught me was integrity, that it is imperative in this world to be truthful and honest. I was taught it's the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And yeah, they really worked hard in medicine, but also to really help build a wonderful community and really believed in this state. I still remember my mom working so desperately hard to get Nancy Landon Kassebaum elected. And what a proud moment That was, and yet now I realize I just took it for granted that a woman would be in the U.S. Senate. Now I get it's a big deal, and we need that kind of leadership. We need people like Nancy who will work across the aisle, and my parents modeled and taught me that behavior.
Was politics talked a lot about at the dinner table?
Oh, goodness, we talked about everything at the dinner table. Mm-hmm. So those were interesting and exciting times. I'll be very honest, as hard as it is to have COVID right now, one of the beautiful things that it's done is bring people back to the dinner table together, to be family and sharing with each other. And I think that's an important thing. So yeah, politics and science and just what's going on, that all was there.
So why did you go into anesthesiology?
My father was an anesthesiologist, and honestly, when I was in medical school, I tried to find anything that wasn't that because I didn't want to, quote, be, you know, just follow in footsteps. And yet, when I asked older physicians and talked about what they'd had, their medical experience, and every single anesthesiologist that I spoke with still loved going to work every day. And that's what I wanted to have in my lifetime, to be able to really improve people's lives in a way that I could love it every day. And so I chose it and became a partner with my father. It was what a wonderful life experience. And it was such a great opportunity to really help make people not hurt. What a great opportunity to be an anesthesiologist.
Well, given all this, maybe it's no surprise that healthcare is your number one issue. What should the federal government be doing right now about COVID-19?
We need the federal government to lead. I have been deeply disappointed in the lack of leadership and the confusing messaging. We must come together and do things like make sure there's personal protective equipment and wear our mask, follow public health advice. And, you know, my opponent, he clearly doesn't follow very simple things like wearing a mask and still shaking hands, gathering in groups, and voted against having actually didn't take a vote on having another relief package come to people who we have families who can't pay their rent and can't feed their kids. And we need help. We need our federal government to lead on this issue and follow science.
How concerned are you about the status of the Affordable Care Act in the next few years?
Depending on who's elected, and I expect that this country will want to elect people who want to get health care to the people, I am a supporter of building on what's working in the Affordable Care Act, things like our protecting people with pre-existing conditions, but allowing people to continue to keep their private health insurance. Another thing that my opponent is misleading the public on. We need competition, but what we also need to do is find ways to lower costs, because the number one thing I am hearing from Kansas is they are struggling with the affordability of healthcare.
How do you do that?
Change that. Well, let's start. We can do one of the easy things to do is to actually negotiate with pharmaceutical companies through Medicare to lower our pharmaceutical prices. And there we are again. My opponent, the congressman, voted no. He wanted to keep drug prices high for people. That is just unconscionable to me. And the whole reason that the president said, let's buy our drugs from Canada, was because they negotiate with pharmaceutical companies, as do most other nations. We need to be able to do that. And that's a start. And then we need to look at things and move forward to get costs lower.
And what else needs to happen there? You mentioned prescription drug prices and driving them lower. What about other healthcare costs?
You know, I think we're going to have to take a serious look at all the ways that we provide the healthcare. And, you know, one of the things that helps reduce parts of the cost are things like telehealth. And it's why we need broadband everywhere. You know, rural Kansans are crying out for that. so that they can have the health care they need. And that can make a difference. We need to find out exactly what a hospital needs to be. We desperately need to have our hospitals. And, you know, one of the things we could do that would help in Kansans that would lower costs across, you know, for all of us is to actually expand Medicaid. We know, and we've seen in other states, that when more people are covered with insurance, the actual cost of the insurance for everyone else goes down. Those are starts.
Now, you've been working on Medicaid expansion for a number of years. It hasn't happened in Kansas. Why has that been such a tough nut for the legislature when polls suggest that Kansans want it?
It is not a tough nut for the legislature. It has been blocked by Republican leadership. We know we have had the votes to pass Medicaid expansion, and just like what's going on in the federal Senate, under that current leadership, blocking all the bills, not moving things forward, we had the same thing in Kansas, where they prevented the bill from moving forward. It passed the House. We couldn't even work it in the Senate. Tragic misuse of the government and our system. People's voices need to be heard. And that's one of the reasons I've always been in office, to listen to the people and move things forward for them. That's what's going wrong.
You know, in the legislature, you worked on surprise medical billing. What is that? What were you doing on it?
This is something, sadly, that ultimately can lead families to having literally bankruptcy or having horrible bills. And to explain it specifically, people who have insurance end up in emergency situations, not infrequently, going to an ER and finding out later that some of the services that were provided in that experience at that hospital weren't covered by their insurance because the people doing it were out of network. And so they end up with this huge bill. And so it's surprise. And they thought they were covered. So my bill brought together insurance companies, providers, patients, EMS, all groups, and, you know, kind of everybody had to give a little, and ultimately it would have put a system in place to figure out how to get those things paid for in a just and way for the actual patient. And this is what's so interesting. Senate President Susan Weigel actually had it in her platform when she was running for U.S. Senate that she wanted to work on ending surprise medical bills. And yet when I brought it forward, she refused to let the bill be heard. Again, politics instead of the people. Isn't it sad?
Kansas State Senator Barbara Beaulieu is my guest. She's a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate in Kansas. Another priority of yours is ethics reform. You call for the overturning of Citizens United, the Supreme Court ruling that opened up political spending. You call for a constitutional amendment to change that ruling. How practical is it to pass a constitutional amendment, which is obviously a formidable task?
You know, we all know that reform is needed for our elective system, particularly around the finance of it. And out of all the times, you know, we're seeing right now how much money is being put into the political sphere, particularly like you look at my opponent who's being bailed out by all these big PACs because, you know, he needs their support because the people aren't necessarily contributing to his campaign. They aren't listening. And I am endorsed by Citizens United. In Citizens United knows we have got to make a change. You know, we'll have to find out because I believe the people of this country are tired of this process and want that change. So if it takes a challenging getting to a constitutional amendment, well, we're going to work to get there because that's what the people are going to be asking us to do.
I think you mentioned a few minutes ago you favor another round of stimulus checks and more aid to small businesses. How much would you be willing to spend? Because there's a disagreement between Speaker Pelosi and the president over just how much money should be included in another round here.
You know, to be clear, the Kansans I've talked to, they really want to get back to work. They either can't because there isn't a job left for them. They don't have childcare, whatever it is. But we know we need to bring people together to the table to talk about. I'm very willing to negotiate what is the right amount of money because, you know, sometimes it takes compromise. But we at least need to have people coming together to do that and be willing to move forward. And I'm always about compromise. And, you know, we just have to find a level of supplemental benefits that both sides can agree on and move it forward for the people.
Barbara, if the package reached $2 trillion, could you back that?
You know, the specific amount of money isn't what really the question is. Let's go back and say, you know, as we look at the federal deficit, when we're in times of plenty, when we have a very strong economic time, that's when we should be paying down our deficit and talking about how we spend. What happened this last go-round was people instead voted for a big tax cut that added $1 trillion to our deficit. Now we're in a crisis, and we know it is going to take a massive amount. I don't know if it's $2 trillion, or I don't know what it's going to be, but we have to protect our economy, keep it going until we have a vaccine in place. The other thing we can do, Steve, just to be clear, is follow public health guidelines. It's the very way we get our economy back on track. If people are wearing masks, if they're social distancing, then we can carry about our business. But if we continue to not lead, people don't lead and don't do those things, it just makes it even worse and will cause it to cost even more.
You know, different topic. How do you address the growing financial inequality in this country? Where does the country need to go to rebalance the fiscal affairs, if you will, of the American people?
What we need to do is make sure that people who are working have a living wage. That is where we begin. And what that needs to be is going to be a little bit different depending on where you live. So I am not in favor of just saying this is the amount of money and everyone needs to have it. I think we need to look at what is appropriate for the area. And but get people, no one should have to work three jobs and still not be able to have health care or even pay for their rent, et cetera. So and what we can do is let's make college more affordable. But of course, it can't be free. That's not something that we can do. We need to be sure people can have opportunity to go, whether it be college or career tech ed or degree programs. We need to help people. And one of the things we could do is start with refinancing debt. But, you know, our whole country needs a strong middle class where people mm-hmm. have a living wage and can do the very things that they want to be able to do to have a thriving family and a thriving life.
Are you talking about a guaranteed income for Americans or simply an hourly wage that's high enough that they can pay their bills and perhaps afford health coverage?
I'm speaking about having a what we have for a minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And I want to be clear, I am not advocating for one minimum wage for the entire country. I think that you need to look in each area because what is needed in a city like San Francisco is going to be different than what you need in a city like Quinner, Kansas. So it needs to be evaluated.
What does the country need to do to address racism? Where do we need to go to make people of color feel more comfortable in their own country?
You know, we know that people have not been listened to, people of color. And it is very clear that racism is a problem and we need to address it. And we start with that by admitting to it and saying, What can we do to make changes? Now, you know, people talk about things like somehow it's tied into funding of the police. And of course I support funding the police. But what I also want people to know is we need the police to have the support systems in place that they need so they can do their job and the people out there can get the care that they need, you know, like mental health centers and substance use disorder centers. That ties into Medicaid expansion, getting money very specifically to our local governments in this pandemic crisis. That's why we need to come together with another relief bill, because, you know, who provides the police but our local government, and they need the money to do that. And racism is a definite issue in this country. We know people have been treated differently by the police. We need them to have anti-bias training. We need to end some things like chokeholds and the like. But it is going to take people saying, let's move forward again and making that happen.
These services that you're talking about, mental health, social workers and the like, does the federal government have a role in paying for all that? Because you just mentioned so much of this falls at the feet of local taxpayers.
Yes, it does. It's called Medicaid expansion. That's you know, we are missing out in Kansas tremendously in the mental health realm because of not expanding Medicaid. And it's not just for those who would have been treated under the Medicaid system. Because the states surrounding us have all, they're all expanding Medicaid, the providers are realizing, why go to Kansas? Because we may not get paid for our services there. So we aren't, we have a problem with even the number of providers, and we need to make it better rather than worse. So that's a very good example of that.
You know, Republicans have run ads attacking your support for a red flag bill, which would allow police or family members to seek a court order to remove firearms from a person they believe poses an immediate threat to themselves or even to others. Do you wish you had that vote back again?
The vote on that? You know, here's the deal. We never have had a vote on that. And our current law in Kansas allows law enforcement to remove weapons without due process around it. And my red flag bill, and it's not just mine, it's the people's, that bill would have put due process around that and tried to help prevent people from potentially committing suicide or an abusive person from having a gun and potentially shooting their spouse. It was really disappointing to me that we were never able to even vote on that bill, because it's a helpful thing. And to be clear, it's temporary, and they go back to the people. The number one issue we need to talk about in gun violence is safety, safety, safety. That's what people need to be focusing on in the presence of the Second Amendment, again, which I completely support.
You know, just a final point. How much campaigning are you doing in person, Barbara? How much campaigning is via Zoom, or is it all via Zoom?
Most of my campaigning now is being done in person, following public health guidelines. We're having these wonderful chats called lawn chair chats around the state. That's where some of those videos that get misrepresented are coming from. It's so wonderful to see the people of this state following public health guidelines and being willing to wear a mask and socially distance, but still come together to hear a candidate. I have loved being able to see the people of Kansas and watch throughout this whole year, truly the beginnings of the tiny little seeds that now are the soybean crop that's being harvested right now. It's wonderful to have watched and have that opportunity. I love being with the Kansans in person, but we do have to do it socially distancing and appropriately. Sadly, again, not what Roger Marshall does.
That's Barbara Beaulieu. She's a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate in Kansas. Senator, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Steve, it's always great to visit with you. Have a great day and be well and safe.
Thank you. After a short break, we'll come back and talk about how ethical is it to not vote in a year like this. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. At election time, there are always significant ethical issues. This year, there seems to be more than usual. This morning, the ethics professors are in the House to talk about whether it's ethical to not vote this year. We'll also talk about this. Do candidates have an obligation to debate or participate in forums, especially after agreeing to do so? Finally, is it fair that President Trump got access to experimental COVID-19 treatments not available to the general public? With us once again are Wayne Vaught. He's the provost and vice president of academic affairs at Utah Valley University. He's the former dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC. Wayne, welcome back. Clancy Martin is a professor of philosophy at UMKC. Clancy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having us on.
Well, Clancy, the turnout in Johnson County this year is expected to top 90%, which is, to my way of thinking, absolutely unheard of. But that also means that 10% of voters won't cast ballots. So I'm wondering, for those who aren't voting, is that ethical? Does every voting age adult have a ethical obligation to express his or her opinion on this presidential race?
Well, you know, there's a debate about this that goes all the way back to, in the Western tradition, it goes all the way back to one of the oldest democracies, the democracy in Athens during Socrates' time, and that was 5th century BC. And Socrates argued that in order to fully be a citizen of a democracy, you had to consent in an ongoing way to the laws, the rules, the principles, and the government of the democracy of which you are a part. Mm-hmm. So in order to really be a free human being in a democracy, you had to vote, because that was a way of you saying, this is what I think is going right in our democracy. This is what I think is going wrong in our democracy. This is how I am a moral agent in the community of which I am a part. So for Socrates, and this is, you know, 2,500 years ago, one of the most important expressions of freedom as a citizen that you have is the moral obligation that you have to vote.
So there's no question then that we all have obligations as citizens of this country, right? I mean, you're saying, Clancy, that extends to this idea of voting.
Yeah, when you think about duties and responsibilities, when you think about morality, one of the first things you think about are duties and responsibilities. So you're thinking about, okay, what do I have to do in order to sort of satisfy myself that I am a good person? Well, if you have a family, probably immediately you start thinking about your responsibilities to your family. You probably think about promises you've made to other people, maybe debts that you owe. Those are a kind of promise. But for Socrates, even more important than your responsibilities to your family, more important than your debts, in many ways more important to your than your responsibilities to yourself, are your responsibilities to the community, to the state or the organization, the social and political organization of which you are a part. So in our case, citizens of the United States of America. And the reason for that is that everything that you have, everything that you are, whether you're married or single, educated or not educated, all of these things come to you through the laws of the state. Mm-hmm. None of them make sense except insofar as they are articulated by the laws of the state. And the way in which you express your approval or disapproval of those laws that constitute really the fabric of who everyone is here in the United States of America is by voting.
Well, Clancy, we're joined by Wayne Vaught now from Utah Valley University. Wayne, are you buying this idea that voting is an ethical obligation that we all share? Yeah, we hope to have Wayne Vaught here in just a couple of minutes. So I guess the question, Clancy, is what argument would you make to someone who is saying, I don't need to do this. It's my right not to.
It certainly is everyone's right not to vote. And I think in those circumstances when, let's say, you consider, you know, we often make moral decisions where we are saying, well, I'm choosing the lesser of two evils. And that we don't normally think that that eliminates the moral decision. It's still a question of, even when both choices are bad, very often we will say, well, you are obligated to choose that which is the less bad, because a more bad choice is obviously not a morally praiseworthy choice. But there could be circumstances in which you would say, well, I think all of my options to vote would imply my consent to a situation which I find to be completely morally corrupt. Mm-hmm. Well, Socrates had an answer for that one too. And he said, if you are simply refusing to vote, what that really shows you is that you are living in the wrong society. And if you truly believe you are living in the wrong society, then the good thing about a democracy like ours and like Socrates is that you are free to leave. You should go live in some other society. And indeed, I have friends, lots of friends, as many of us do, who say that if this election turns out the wrong way, that's precisely what they are going to do. Of course, a lot of them said the same thing in 2016 and they still stuck around. So we'll see. But
I'm getting the impression, Clancy, that Socrates had an answer to just about everything.
Well, he had strong views, particularly about moral philosophy, and incredibly influential views. You know, Socrates was the hero of virtually all of the philosophers who founded this government, or the American government.
Well, yeah, this conversation has me thinking about a new tactic we're seeing in politics, where some groups are actually mining voter rolls to figure out who's cast ballots and who hasn't. They can't tell, obviously, what people have voted for, who they voted for, but they can't tell whether you voted or not. And they're using that tactic, that shame, as a way to induce people to get out and vote. That's something new in our politics. I guess the question becomes then, what do we need to do to, do we have any recourse if someone is saying they're not going to vote? How do we motivate them to vote?
Well, more than Socrates, a student of his, you know, Plato was a student of Socrates, and then Aristotle was a student of Plato. And Aristotle talks about this. Now, Aristotle, like Plato, his own teacher, was not a fan of democracy. They both became very suspicious of democracy because, in large part, because of what the Athenian democracy did to Socrates, which was executed him on some trumped up charges. Mm-hmm. But Aristotle talks about the question of how are we going to get our citizens to satisfy the obligations they have to the community of which they are a part. And for Aristotle, there's really only one. You can do it through the law, but he thinks ultimately the law is going to be only somewhat effective because people are very good at not doing what they don't want to do. So he says the best way is to educate people from a very early age so that their preferences agree with their obligations. Mm-hmm. So he says you have to start the moral training of a citizen basically as soon as they're out of the womb.
That's interesting.
And yeah, and I think that, you know, I mean, I have a lot of my students coming to me these in the past 2 months or so asking questions about politics. And a lot of the time it's a kind of veiled, this is who I'm going to vote for. Do you think that's okay? Or even much more direct than that. And sometimes it's just like, well, who do you think I should vote for and why? Mm-hmm. And when you get those kinds of questions as a professor, you always say, well, look, it's really important that you do this work on your own and think it through, et cetera, et cetera. And for me, when I get those questions, I'm always encouraged because it shows that someone has been involved in this 18 or 19 year old's education so that they're thinking about these political questions and they're worrying about them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you've spent dedicated much of your life to politics, Steve, and I always like to think that, you know, it would be nice if we could get people like you, like other people who've dedicated their lives to understanding politics, in contact with children at a much earlier age,
right, you
know, rather than waiting until their college age. So that, you know, my niece just went to vote for the first time in Texas the other day, and they had their Biden hats and their Biden t-shirts and everything as they were going to vote in Fort Worth, Texas, where she told me they were kind of the odd person out, at least with respect to the university where she goes. And I was very proud of my little brother that they were going on the first day,
right,
of early voting, and that he was taking his daughter. And I could tell he was really excited about it too. And it wasn't just that who she was voting for. It was really the fact that she was voting.
Right.
You know? Although
right.
We all would have been.
Clint, let me hop in here and get a phone call here. Don from Kansas City, Missouri. Don, you're on Up to Date.
Okay, thank you. Professor, would you please explain to me why a person has a right not to vote? Maybe I missed it, but I don't understand the logic of that.
Let me get Wayne Vaught in here from Utah Valley University to join this conversation. Wayne, do you want to take that question?
Thanks, Steve, for doing it right at me. You know, there's a right, certainly, and privilege to be able to vote. It's enshrouded by the Constitution. I think that, you know, instead of, we can talk about it in the rights language. I think one of the real challenges is thinking about this in terms of relationships. And sometimes local politics and local issues matter because people really feel connected to those issues, and they'll get out and they'll support candidates and things. I think there's a real sense, and particularly right now, of disconnectedness, particularly at the federal level, and people feeling disconnected from a lot of the politics that's going on. And so I think that probably influences people's willingness or desire to get out and vote. But you talk about a right not to vote. I don't think that there's anything legally that compels one that says, you know, this is a statutory requirement or a legal requirement that you do. I think that clearly there are moral responsibilities and obligations mm-hmm. that a person has to do this. Because you're being part of a democracy. Now, if you don't know what's going on, you're not paying any attention to the politics. I mean, maybe there's some ethical obligation not to be involved if you really aren't a student of the issues and you're just kind of, well, I don't know, I'm just going to.
So what do you do to people out there in Utah, Wayne, who don't cast a ballot?
Oh, I don't know that we do anything. Actually, Utah has, I just got my ballot in the mail. They send them all out. Every Utah resident gets their ballots in the mail.
Right.
I was talking to people. People don't even know where to go vote in the poll places because it's almost entirely done by mail here.
That's interesting.
It has been for a while.
Well, let's turn.
I think that encourages people to do it.
Let's turn the subject here a little bit and get to this one. Do candidates have an obligation to debate or participate in forums, especially after agreeing to do so? I'm struck by the fact that the Shawnee Mission Post, the publication in Northeast Johnson County, has had a series of Republican candidates drop out of their forums, with some of those dropouts coming on the day the forum was going to take place. Clancy, what do you make of that? Is there an ethical obligation to debate for candidates?
Well, as you point out, one of the core ideas that we all share, one of the deep intuitions that we have in common when it comes to thinking about the difference between good and bad, is a keeping of our promises. So the first thing is, if you have agreed to do something, the bedrock of the difference between right and wrong is honoring that agreement, unless there are very strong reasons that you should no longer honor that agreement. But there's a strong, on the face of it, yes, once we've made an agreement, we are to keep that agreement. This is the whole notion of a contract, the notion of a promise, etc. Second, when it comes to the question of a functional democracy, again, going back to the Athenian model of a democracy, when the Athenians were thinking about any kind of decision at all as a populace, they would get everybody together, as many as possible, and they'd argue about it and talk it through, and then they'd take a vote on it, and everybody who was a citizen was allowed to have a vote, and they did this, and, you know, all the way down to the tiniest little laws. We don't do that, but, you know, there's a there's a big movement. I'm sure you know much more about it than I do, Steve, based out of, you know, championed by a guy named Fishkin, a former professor of mine who's at Stanford now, called informed democracy, various kinds of formulations of informed democracy. And what they do is they go around to these countries around the world that are having referenda, and they take a sample of the population who, you know, a random sample of the population. They put them in a room, and for 3 days, they just give them nothing but information about what it is that the country is going to be voting on. They look at their vote before the information and after the information and education. And of course, the vote very often changes significantly. And the reason that that matters is that in order for us to make good votes, as Wayne was saying a moment ago, we actually have to be informed about these issues. And how are we going to be informed about these issues unless the candidates are providing that information? And one of the best ways we have for receiving that information from candidates right now are these, you know, televised debates, radio debates, forums in which the candidates actually have to argue with each other and reveal what their policies are, and very often wind up making promises that we will then expect them to keep if they do, in fact, win and assume office.
Right.
So I think it's incredibly important. You know, the Washington Post has this this tagline, democracy dies in darkness. The idea is that behind these debates is that we need the light of knowledge, the light of transparency,
right,
the light
right.
of information so that we can make good decisions as the democracy. So I think it's vitally important.
You know, Wayne, I can't help but think, you know, how much of a political consequence is there these days if a candidate simply won't debate, particularly for some of these down ballot races like state senate or state representative, you know, that kind of thing, because I'm thinking there really isn't that big of a price to pay.
For not debating?
For not debating, right.
Well, and I think, you know, the downstream ones are the ones that are even more important. Those are, you know, the representatives, whether they're the Senate or even certainly in the House of Representatives, or have a much smaller constituency, and they're supposed to be interacting with and representing their districts. And so I think that it becomes even more important at that level to be engaged and provide opportunities for candidates to have conversations. And I know in Kansas, when we were there, there were multiple times when candidates' representatives were just flat out refused to participate in conversations with the constituents. And that just really confuses me. It doesn't make sense. Again, as Clancy was saying, in a democracy where there's supposed to be an open, free exchange of ideas and understanding and give the voters the opportunity to even understand what they're voting for, but I think more importantly, to get communication going the opposite direction, particularly after the elections, they're still, you know, they shouldn't just be leaving. They should still be engaged with the constituents, hearing what their concerns are and representing those back at the federal level.
Huh. Yeah, you wonder if these people are in the right line of work, really, if they don't want to talk to their constituents and listen to other people's views and explain their views. It seems like maybe they ought to, you know, because it is a democracy and you're not going to get the job unless we want you to have it.
Yeah. But it's interesting, you know, in the metro area, there's been a whole host of candidates who are declining to appear in forums, who are declining to answer questions. And it's been a trend we've seen that's troubling to a lot of us who cover this stuff. And I got 20 seconds left, Wayne. Are you seeing some of that out in Utah?
No, not as much. And I think maybe it's just a smaller and different political environment. But, you know, I agree that that you're seeing that. And I think what it is that people are just wanting to control the messaging. They don't want to be challenged openly and publicly. And if they can go on Twitter, if they can go on their feeds and Instagram, however they're communicating, that's what they're wanting to do. I want to control the message, and I want to control what the reporter's getting. And so I can do that in this environment. I can't do it in an open forum.
That's interesting.
And I think it's just a deliberate attempt to that. It's actually just to control
right.
the messaging.
That's Wayne Vaught. He's a provost and vice president of academic affairs at Utah Valley University. Clancy Martin also joined us, a professor of philosophy at UMKC. Gentlemen, we sure appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Steve.
That's it for today. We'll see you tomorrow.